So we're going to move on now and talk about the second clinical state that we wanted to get into here, which is so-called hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. So this is a situation where the man has metastatic disease but has never had hormonal therapy. And as I mentioned before, that could be a patient presenting with metastatic disease or in terms of disease recurrence. And to get into that, we're going to hear about Kara's 57-year-old man who actually presented with metastatic disease. What happened there, Kara?
Sure. So this is another patient that I care for with Matthew, and I chose these cases sort of knowing that we'd be doing this together, and he'd certainly have a lot to add. But this is another young gentleman who was diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer. And as you can see, you know, through all of this, had a high Gleason score, had measurable lymph nodes on his CAT scan. He did not have any bone lesions, but had this high PSA. And the thing that I was important to think about with him when we thought about adding on, I'll move through, you know, he started Lupron, but I'll start off with how we decided to use enzalutamide versus abiraterone. And for this gentleman, the important part about his past medical history was his diabetes and his difficulty managing his weight. So as we looked through his glucose control, as we looked through his history of hypertension, thinking about some of the side effects that patients experience with abiraterone when we need to use prednisone, we would only make this course more difficult for him with weight gain and glucose control. So it is what pushed us to start off with enzalutamide for him. To date, and we just saw him very recently, he is tolerating all of it well. He does have the known side effects of hot flashes, which are a little bit worse for him as our weather's finally getting warmer here in New England. But he is able to manage his glucose fairly well at this point. He is struggling with his weight because of hormone therapy, but I think the fact that he doesn't have the prednisone on board is helping him.
So Rob, we talked about anti-androgens and how they work and how they're used in M0 disease. They're also used in metastatic diseases. This man's receiving enzalutamide. But can you also talk about the other type of secondary hormonal therapy that was just referred to, abiraterone and prednisone, what the mechanism of action is and how it's used clinically, Rob?
Sure. Abiraterone is what's called a lyase inhibitor, and basically metabolically it leads to the stoppage of production of testosterone, even from peripheral sources. And remember, in prostate cancer cells sort of can make their own testosterone. So this lyase inhibitor basically leads to essentially unmeasurable in the serum testosterone levels. In many ways, all of these agents, both the lyase inhibitors and the androgen receptor antagonists, have all been studied for the most part in the same settings. The only setting in which abiraterone wasn't tested was in the M0 castrate-resistant setting. So in the hormone-sensitive metastatic setting, multiple agents are used routinely in the hormone-sensitive setting. And outside of this particular case where there was concern about prednisone, abiraterone and 5 milligrams of prednisone is very, very well tolerated and is widely used as a primary treatment along with testosterone suppression with an LHRH agonist.
So the actual choices, and again, thinking back to Vicky's scale thing about how to balance out, this is one of the most complicated situations, I think, in all of oncology, not just prostate cancer. And now you have layered in, you know, COVID considerations. But Matthew, can you maybe first comment on the CT of this man showing the lymph node that was involved? Any comments on that?
So I think the point here is that this is a aorta caval or retrocaval node. So this is outside the pelvis. He also had big pelvic lymph nodes. Mm-hmm. So he really had de novo metastatic prostate cancer classified as, you know, if you like the terminology, low volume, did not involve bone, but nonetheless has the real thing with metastatic disease. And which is why we elected to treat him in a proactive way, based on, you know, good evidence for intensification of initial systemic treatment.
So maybe you can comment on that, Matthew, because, you know, in the past, patients like this would get androgen deprivation, as we just described. Actually, you know, surgical orchiectomy was the initial therapy, mm-hmm. and then fortunately these drugs came along. So these men often had very, you know, long responses, and I kind of found it surprising. All of a sudden, a bunch of trials came up that said, okay, yeah, they have great responses, but suppose we add a hormone, suppose we add chemo. And we're going to sort of go through some of the trials behind that. But Matthew, can you just talk right now, when you see a patient who presents like that, sort of what the options are that you might be considering, and also whether the way you look at this is different now? We know Boston had a serious problem, and still does, but a lot better with COVID, but how these decisions been affected by COVID, Matthew?
Sure. So big picture, to generalize this, you know, drugs that were approved for castration-resistant disease were moved up the line in clinical trials to see if you could improve overall outcomes. And the consistent observation is, yes, you can. And that should be the new standard of care for many patients with de novo metastatic or recurrent metastatic disease. And it's striking to know that at least market data suggests that there's actually very poor uptake of this approach. And part of that, I think, reflects the fact that the message just hasn't gotten out there. There's a lot of misunderstanding based on the early docetaxel data of the high volume, low volume distinctions. And it's not necessarily perceived as an area of unmet need, because nearly all patients respond to initial ADT alone. So what's the problem? Just give them ADT and wait. But that's, in fact, the question that the studies addressed, which is, should you intensify therapy? And a clear benefit's been demonstrated. In this patient, I think you asked a few questions there about chemotherapy with docetaxel versus an oral agent. Here's a setting where actually the data for chemotherapy in low volume or better prognosis disease is unclear. So you might argue that there isn't strong data for chemotherapy in this setting, and the data is arguably better, or at least it exists, for the oral agents extending to patients with lower volume disease. It's also, or more favorable disease, it's also a lot easier for patients to accept that option of treatment. And so for the most part, we use the oral agents when we intensify systemic treatment. I wouldn't fault anyone who chose docetaxel, particularly for patients with a poor prognosis, extensive metastatic disease. Not that we know it's better, but at least I see there's at least evidence supporting its use. There isn't great head-to-head trial, although the STAMPEDE trial data does suggest that there are benefits of abiraterone over docetaxel in this setting.
So it's interesting, that perspective, Rob, because one of the things I heard in the past from people when I asked them that same question I just asked Matt, I heard a lot of people said, well, you get about the same benefit with docetaxel as you do with hormonal therapy, and that some people actually prefer docetaxel. Some patients prefer, because you kind of get it over with. And of course, that was pre-COVID. I don't know how that's changed with the COVID situation. But just kind of curious for your take on the alternatives in this situation, Rob, and how you process that with your patients.
Sure. And, you know, obviously, Dr. Smith just focused on one area. I mean, one of the challenges, depending on where you are in the country, is I happen to be at a place where some of my patients, not because they love me, but they need to drive 7 hours each way. Some can't afford the copays associated with the drugs, and therefore docetaxel, because it's a parenteral agent, becomes the only way for these folks to get treated. So I think ultimately patients need to, you know, in some instances, if you hate taking pills, then you're going to wind up wanting docetaxel.
So Kara, I'm kind of curious how this man responded to this situation. We talked about, you know, sort of the shock of being diagnosed with prostate cancer earlier. Now you're talking about the shock of being diagnosed with metastatic mm-hmm. prostate cancer. How did this man react, and what's it been like to take care of him? What happened?
Sure. So, you know, as he's actively going through treatment now, he, I think, feels more confident. So I think one of the things that I see with patients, and certainly my colleagues can certainly add in here, is that as patients adjust to their treatment, you actually see that their confidence increases, where they get more comfortable asking questions as they understand more about the side effects they're experiencing. And so what I've actually seen from a psychosocial aspect is he's a lot more comfortable coming in for visits and asking more questions about his prognosis, and which we talked about early on, but now he's sort of saying, so do you think it's okay if I plan a vacation in 6 months, if we're ever allowed to fly again? You know, do you think I can think about taking a new job in a few months? So I think he's more confident to ask those questions. And in the beginning, when he was first diagnosed, when we made these recommendations and he made the decision to pursue that, you know, there was this mentality of, I want to do whatever I need to do to survive, and I'm going to say yes to all these things. And he's done that, and he's having a nice response with an undetectable PSA. And so now that the dust is settling, he's thinking more about what this means for lifelong, you know, life in a long-term way, which I actually think is really nice. So it's nice to actually have those kind of visits where you can talk about what life looks like beyond the initial diagnosis.
Curious what your thoughts are about this, Vicki, and how, you know, we talk about, and we've been talking for a long time about what we call the bond that heals, which is the relationship that we have with patients, and the fact that that itself is a tremendous value that they value in these difficult situations. Vicki, any comments on how you see men adjusting to dealing with metastatic prostate cancer?
You know, I see that most of the men eventually adjust. They either are, just like Kara said, they want to do anything to survive. There are other patients that will say, gee, look, I've lived my life and all I want is not to be in pain. And if, you know, and do I really need this treatment? And if I don't really need it, how long do you think I will have to live? So again, you see patients at both sides of the spectrum, and you just have to actually adjust what you recommend to meet those patients' needs. Every patient is individualized care. Mm-hmm. It's so different. I mean, we don't have a cure, so it's kind of like whatever suits that patient, we kind of go with it, especially if it's not something that's going to harm them.
So in a second, I want Rob to kind of go through some of the basic trials that were done addressing this. But just to come back to Kara, and I think there's a question in the chat room about management of hot flashes. Mm. But I'm also curious in general, Kara, of any complementary strategies you find helpful for patients, hot flashes or any, you know, stress, anything else, yoga, any augmentation that you find useful, Kara?
Sure. So that's something we try to talk about in the beginning when patients are diagnosed. So I think one, it gives them a better sense of control that there is something that they can do to help control the side effects that they're having. So from the outset, when we talk about the side effects, hot flashes, which can interrupt sleep, we really sort of try and lay out, here are complementary options. There are some patients who say, I really want to try acupuncture. Do you think it will help? We know that there certainly aren't any real side effects to acupuncture. And if there is a positive benefit, we say go for it. We also try to talk about things like black cohosh as a supplement for hot flashes. And then we also like to tell people, if you are really bothered by hot flashes, you have tried meditation, which can be helpful for all of us for stress reduction. If you've tried acupuncture or acupressure, or you've tried lifestyle modification with being more active and avoiding weight gain, and all of those lifestyle things aren't working, we can try medical management. There are medications that we can use that can decrease hot flashes. They also have some side effects, so we don't recommend them lightly, but I think it's just important for patients to know there are options we can investigate at each path and to communicate with us along the way. So we talk about patients who are starting Lupron, and as Vicki mentioned, we have 1 month, 3 month, 4 month, 6 month depots. If you have a patient who's getting a 3 or 4 month or a 6 month depot, you might not be seeing them for a while. And then these side effects may have really started in between these visits. And then by the time they come in to see you, they say, I've had the most terrible few months. and this has been lousy and I don't think I can continue. So sometimes if we can cut off those side effects at the pass with telephone visits or, you know, patients like to email, it can help manage those side effects better.
So Vicki, maybe you can take a couple questions I see coming in the chat room. One person is talking about support groups that separate the men from the women and then bring them back together. Another question about intermittent androgen deprivation as a way to decrease the side effects. Any comment about support groups and intermittent androgen deprivation, Vicki?
So we do recommend support groups, but many men, they don't like to hear about other men's problems. So just in my own experience, a lot of men will say, yes, I would like to go to a support group, but I would like it online where I'm not actually listening to other people's problems. They just want a support group to hear about what's new out there and like what they can do to help themselves. With regard to separating the men.
Intermittent hormonal therapy, stopping it.
Okay, that with regard to intermittent hormonal therapy, the reason why we give this is we generally will give this to patients who have no mets, who just have a rising PSA, and we do see a decrease in terms of overall side effects. The reason we do this is so that men who have an issue with erectile dysfunction and impotency and decreased libido, they can actually recover from this during their off times.
And Rob, I want to let you take a look at some of the trials, but also curious about your thoughts about intermittent androgen deprivation. It is kind of a strange thing where you stop the therapy, you let the PSA go up to a certain point, and then you treat and drive it down. It kind of seems a little scary. Do you do that in your practice, Rob?
So I don't use a lot of hormonal therapy for PSA-only disease. In those settings in which I do, I think, you know, there's level one evidence to support it. In metastatic disease, especially with bone metastases, I do not. Patients with sort of nodal disease, like the case we saw earlier with a favorable sort of a Gleason 6 discussion, and it's reasonable for certainly for some patients.
So, Rob, can you comment on the data looking at adding in more on top of androgen deprivation in this situation? We were talking about abiraterone, and also, you know, some of these trials tried to tease out whether it had a lot of mets or not that many mets. But can you just kind of provide an overview, Rob, of what was seen in these trials when they added stuff to ADT?
Sure. As Dr. Smith has already said, the early trials first involved docetaxel, and, you know, sort of broke out patients based on high and low volume disease. The Latitude study followed using abiraterone with a somewhat different sort of definition. Stampede trials done in the UK also did trials with docetaxel and abiraterone. Basically, all of these trials showed survival benefit, which led to the introduction and the adoption, at least in many academic centers. I think Dr. Smith is spot on. The adoption throughout the community has been a little less than optimal, perhaps. Subsequently, trials with enzalutamide and apalutamide across all groups, meaning all comers, have now basically shown survival. So we're now at a place where you have multiple drugs to choose from, all basically showing that you can move the needle in terms of survival. There should be very few patients who don't warrant consideration of intensification.
I got to say, I'm really surprised at that thought that a lot of men are not receiving this treatment. Maybe we deal with people who are better informed. It seems like everybody is aware of it, but sometimes
Neil, you get some... Part of the issue is that, and something we haven't talked about, is that prostate cancer is one of those diseases that get treated by a lot of people. So our urologic colleagues, both in the community, some academic urologists, our community medical oncologists, every once in a while, other clinicians who, you know, sort of feel comfortable getting things started. So I think that that's a unique thing to prostate cancer. It's a heterogeneous disease managed by a heterogeneous group of clinicians.
Well, when you think about the benefit here in survival and the fact that these men are able to delay, you know, having symptoms and having chemotherapy, it really is something I think every nurse should be aware of and checking the chart and see whether or not they're having additional therapy added on.